Good morning, guys. I'm an alcoholic, and I am Paul. What's the point? What's the point? There's a fellow who always would ask that when anybody would read How It Works at a meeting, and say we're not saints, and he'd say, "What's the point?" And the point is, we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. Am I willing to grow along spiritual lines today and every day? There is one who has all power. That one is God. You must find him now, which is the way it was said in the original How It Works. If you don't mind, I'd like to I prayed for all of you this morning. You didn't know it. We have that that prayer list, which is wonderful. I noticed there's a guy named Paul on there, so I guess I'm covered. But anyway, I want my first thoughts to go to God because, interestingly enough, today I have 5,900 days away from a drink. That's I guess 16 years and almost 2 months. So I'm 2 months into my 17th year. My sobriety, well, they took me into my last mental ward on December 21st of 2009. So the interesting thing about that, I'm going to get to the prayer in a second, but the interesting thing to me about that is I had no idea that I would stop drinking. I never asked God to help me stop drinking. I never picked up a drink after I got out of there on January 1st. Of 2010. When I read in the book, our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depends on our constant thought of others and what we can do to help fill their needs or meet their needs, I realized that maybe I was given this gift of sobriety or dryness at the time for sure, but I was given that gift because while I was in that mental ward, it seemed like I cared more about all my crazy fellow people in that mental ward, men and women, who were everything from drug addicts to alcoholics to severely mentally ill people. And they had the little half and halves on the trays, you know. And I would collect those because there was a little refrigerator in the lunchroom. And I would take jams and jellies and make little milkshakes in the medicine cups for all my crazy friends. And there was a box of crayons, and I drew for a living. I'll get into later, but I helped other people draw. And the interesting thing is that I had one of those drawings. In fact, I did a book called In and Out of the Nut House because I was in so many times. But anyway, I guess I cared more about those people than myself because, and I was given this gift of sobriety, but I need to now maintain it, and so I do. But anyway, I want my first thoughts to go to our Creator in the morning. So if you will, if you think about this prayer, you will have prayed for people in Spain. You will have prayed for people in England. You will have prayed for somebody in France who's falling off a bar stool. You will have prayed for someone getting electroshock therapy in Portugal. And it goes like this: God, please bless all alcoholics who are sober today. Give grace to those who are on their way. But please, God, show compassion and mercy to those who may never come or come to believe. I was told that that prayer is read at the beginning of every meeting out in Alexander, New York. I've never been to that meeting, but I wrote it down because it really sounded good to me. And when I realized the power of that prayer and that we were talking to God, to the universe, to our Creator, to the cause of everything that we see and look at and live with, and all the people that are afflicted by our illness, it's very powerful. So I thank you for listening to that. And if you closed your eyes a little bit or just thought about it, in my book, you prayed for somebody, for all those people who are alcoholic today. I'm 76 years old. My prognosis at one of my many, I was in a lot of different places, not just drunk tanks, but mental wards. And in my second time at ECMC, which is a mental hospital here, our Dr. Silkworth, really, as in Buffalo, he's retired now. He had me listed as bipolar, manic, suicidal, depressed, alcohol dependent, and my prognosis was grave. I was having mental seizures. I was bleeding from every opening. I was going to church every day, and I was going to meetings every day. And I stayed drunk, and sometimes I would come home at night, and sometimes I wouldn't come home at night. So I fully realize now that alcoholism is a symptom of, or is an illness of mental capacity for me. My dad had electroshock therapy. His dad had electroshock therapy. Interestingly enough, they were both liquor salesmen, as my brother was, who died a year ago. He would tell you that he died from diabetes, but the truth is, you know, he died because he was you know, the causes and conditions were that, you know, he would come home from what his wife would say, and, you know, fall down in the driveway and not get up until the next day. So I'm sure that he was given the gift of our illness, the illness that we share. But it's not my place to judge any of them. So getting back to just my story, since it's our thinking, not our drinking, that's the problem. The drinking may be the solution to the poor thinking. I realized that early on in life, I was an obsessive thinker about myself. I was seeking other people's approval. I was seeking other people's pity. I was seeking other people's love, and didn't realize that I had it all along. At 7 years old, or 10 years old, there was a beach up in Canada called Elko Beach. It was Shirkston Beach. It was right on Lake Erie. You could drive the cars down onto the beach, and there were sand hills that you climbed up and stuff. And I loved the water. I loved swimming. But I sat in the car with the accessory on, listening to the radio with a t-shirt on. And when I would go into the water, I'd keep the t-shirt on, because I was a chunky boy and I had boy boobs. And the interesting thing about that, and I used to obsess about that, and I used to sit, my little quiet space was a place through the closet that was, interestingly enough, under the steps, under the stairs. And I'd sit in there, and I would think to myself that I was half man and half woman. And that was before puberty. So that was an interesting, it's just interesting to look back at that. And the reason that I bring that up is because I was asked at four years in Rochester to do a lead. And that came out of me, that idea about boy boobs. And I thought to myself, what did that have to do with alcoholism? Why did I even say that? And then all of a sudden I found out why I said it. There was a large African-American guy in the room. And after he raised his hand, and I, you know, I called on him, and he said, you know, I never told anybody, but I had the same exact feelings. And it dawned on me why God asked me, somehow in my mind without knowing it, to say that so that he could be relieved of his emotional issue. So I was raised Roman Catholic, and then I became a Catholic Roman. I was Roman in the gentlemen clubs. I was Roman, you know, sometimes not coming home. Rose, the lady that married me, who is in the kitchen right now, and we've been married 53 years, stayed with me, and I don't know why. I graduated in art, and I got a job in advertising, and I got a job offer somehow in St. Louis. I went to St. Louis. I had worked on, interestingly enough, introducing Anheuser-Busch Natural Light beer, which became called Just Natural. I worked with celebrities. I ended up in Chicago at the Leo Burnett Company. This is one of the largest agencies in the world, and then end up at Bozell Advertising, where I worked on pork, the other white meat. I didn't come up with that. I could have lied and said, like the 20 some people that claimed it, but I did have the keys to that other white meat truck, and the pork producers come up and go, "Hey Paul, when can we become like the white meat?" You know. And I said, when you boys sell as much meat as the chicken boys. And they'd laugh, and son of a bitch, Paul, you bastard, you know. And I said, never. You went from death meat to health food almost in like four little words, and you want to change it? Anyway, I don't know why I'm saying that stuff. Long and short of it is, Rose promised her dad. Rose is comes from an Orthodox Jewish family. Her mother and father both had families, and the families were taken away and sent to the fires. We came here. Her father threw me out of the house at first. And then we moved away and moved back to Buffalo because she promised her dad that she would take care of her mother. My dad had passed away. My mother had passed away. Since then, we have four boys in our family. There's one left besides me. My youngest brother put a gun in his mouth in Florida. The other brother I talked about. When we were moving back here, two things of interest. I was in Chicago at a place called Club Lucky and got really, really drunk. Told a young man who worked for me that I wanted to ride his motorcycle. He had a Harley CH-900. I got on it, started it, gunned it, and went right across the street and hit into a parked car, which was the owner of Club Lucky. And the bike went under, I went over, and here's the good news. I never have to answer this question. Do you floss? My teeth sleep in a cup, and I gum my donut and swallow my pride. That was Club Lucky. I didn't know it at the time. Anyway, The other thing is that I made Super Bowl commercials and other things that I helped create. And I was in New Orleans because there was a TV chef there named Justin Wilson. And we wanted to use some of his footage. He would, you know, he was the Cajun gourmet, you know, he'd be cutting up licks of pork chop or something. He'd say, "This piggy never knew he tasted so good, I guarantee." Anyway, I'm in New Orleans, and the woman that worked for me had a contract for the guy to sign. We signed the contract. We're in a bar at about 10, 11 o'clock in the morning before we went to the airport, and the bar is pretty full of people. I said to the bartender, I said, "You know, you must have a lot of alcoholics down here in New Orleans." And he said, "No." Said alcoholics go to meetings. We got drunks down here. And he laughed and she laughed. And of course, I laughed because I never knew what the hell he was talking about. But the truth is, they knew about it and I didn't even know about Alcoholics Anonymous. So we're moving back here. I've got a Dodge Durango with a big U-Haul trailer on the back of it. And I pull out of, and I pull out of Chicago after selling our beautiful home in Chicago and Riverside, Illinois. It's just starting to snow a little bit, and I'm in Indiana. And all of a sudden, I see a seal in the middle of the road with a ball on its nose. And I lock the brakes up, and the thing starts to skid. Rose said, "You know, what are you doing?" And I said, "Did you see that?" And it dissipated right before I got there. And from there in Indiana, which was pretty close, I decided not to drink before I drove to Buffalo with all our junk and our dogs. And anyways, so all the way back, I saw children walking onto the road. Trees were turning into large woolly mammoths and all kinds of things. I hallucinated all the way to Hamburg, New York, driving a trailer full with my family, my wife in it. So I was dying, I guess, of alcoholism, and I never knew it. And you all would say, because I was taken to a meeting, and I went to a meeting, and I just got a donut, and I was a member of the 10 o'clock meeting club here around Chicago. I would go to church every morning, so I went to mass. I would go to the meeting. I would make coffee at the meeting. I would put a spread on the table for the group was called the Three-Way Group. I put a spread on the table with bagels and cream cheese and bananas and strawberries, and it was a little bit over the top. I carried my big book around so that you thought I knew what I was doing. And then I got drunk. And then I went to gentlemen clubs. Then I came home, or I didn't. And this happened and happened and happened and happened. So the idea of meeting makers make it right back to a bottle of Maker's Mark for this alky. Find God. Why would a guy like me, who was trained as a Eucharistic minister in the Catholic Church, why would a guy like me need to read We Agnostics? But I was living as an agnostic, and never knew it. It didn't say those crazy agnostics over there. It said we agnostics. So I somehow stumbled into it. And I will say one more thing about a God moment in my life. Early on, I was maybe 3 months away from a drink, and I went out to a McDonald's. I was smoking still at the time, and I was on my way out to the Native reservation to buy cigarettes. And I stopped to buy a egg muffin and a orange juice and stuff, and I was coming out of the McDonald's, and I was overwhelmed by Alcoholics Anonymous at the time. I was overwhelmed by you all, because I had a beautiful home, a couple of vehicles, a couple of dogs. I'm sober. I can't even believe I'm sober. And I said, perhaps from my mind, the most impactful prayer I ever said in my life. I looked up in the air, and I was crying, and I yelled out, "God, I'm okay. Take care of those people in those rooms. Take care of them." And I got in my truck, and I turned on the radio, and the music, country music, was playing. I took a bite of a hash brown, and there was a rosary hanging on my mirror, which hangs in my current truck. It's a different one. And I started to say the Lord's Prayer for you all, for you all. Because I mean, I heard about lawyers that are living in mattresses and abandoned homes and shit, And I've heard stories about, horrible things that have happened to people in these meetings. And all of a sudden, I thought I was dying. Somehow I was being lifted up or something. It was just weird. I stopped. I spit my thing out. I turned the truck off, and I just sat there. And I heard these words come to my mind, you know, not like a big, not out loud or anything, but this thought comes to my mind. Don't worry, Paul, your job's not done yet. And at the time I had a sponsor, and he said, do you realize you've been contacted? And he said, you know, you can never drink again. And I said, you know, I kind of knew that. And that was, so I called this dude, you know, he's got a Southern accent. He's really the cool guy. And I said, Jess, you know, I think I just had one of those spiritual experiences. You know, he said, Paul. Says in the book, haven't had a spiritual awakening on these as a result of these steps. Now, where are you on the steps? I said, I don't know. it was certainly a spiritual intervention. All that day, you could have taken my arm and broke it, and I would have said, thank you. So I learned a valuable lesson between the nut house and there that I should never pray for myself. As Bill Wilson says in his story when he's talking through the steps, he says, never should I pray for myself unless it would benefit others, I'm paraphrasing. Then and only then could I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure. And I don't know about anybody else, but I'm an expectation. I was expecting and everything. And I learned from that that I can expect good results if I pray for you. Whoever you are, you know, the family afterwards for me is the family of life, the family of man, and it includes everyone. So let me just kind of get into the steps, and Jim shut me up, you know, so many words, so little time. I learned that in advertising, you know what I mean? So shut me up if I go too long or anybody else, but I looked at those things hanging from the ceiling, you know, the traditions and the steps, and I said, step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, long dash, that our lives have become unmanageable. Oh, I drank too much, so I screwed everything up. No, Paul. Maybe you, if that kept you sober at the beginning, God bless you, and he did. What it says is, I can't manage my own life, so I got drunk. It's my mind that is a more severe part of my illness. I don't know about anybody else, but that's the way I look at it. So I heard two guys talking at the eye-opener meeting, and I don't know who they are, to be honest. I don't remember. It was a long time ago. And one guy said to the other, you know, the longer I stay sober, the more important that first step is. I thought, that sounds interesting, but I didn't get it at the time. I kind of understand that pretty well now. You know, I don't manage my life well. I never will. So come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. As I said before, I didn't need to read We Agnostics, but boy, did I walk into these rooms with a lot of prejudice. I went to church. How about you, Jim? I know you guys are shaking hands, eating cookies, hugging each other and all that shit. I went to church this morning. No prejudice there. You know, as I said about the lady that married me, Rose, you know, she was raised as an Orthodox Jew, where the temple is like the men here and the women there and kind of stuff. And anyway, so, there's some feeling that they were the chosen people. And I was told that the chosen people are the people who chose God. That he plays no favorites. He loves you as much as he loves me. And he loves all of God, loves God's creation, period. And I kind of like that notion. I kind of hang on to that. So how do I practice that step? I get on my knees every morning. I want my first thoughts to go to God. I say the third step prayer. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thy will. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I better do thy will. Take away all of my difficulties that victory over them would bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do I will always, to build with me. There's the key of step three. God's going to use me if I'm open enough and willing enough to let that happen, to let that come in and work. And it does work now. And I say it every day. And I say the seventh step every day. A prayer every day. And then I say an affirmation prayer. So welcome to step four. So I did this inventory, and my dad, had a degree in art, and he has some amazing artwork. I couldn't even clean his brushes, and he pushed me to go through college and stuff like that. And I stumbled through. I was building houses in the morning, failing out of college in the afternoon, and drinking myself silly and tending bar at night. I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. Anyway, my dad was in that first column, the first one in the first column. I was resentful at my father because he was living his failure in life through me. Imagine that, me thinking of me. What did that affect? You know, everything. But anyway, forget that. So I did this resentment thing. I resented my brother that died because he got our family house and for real cheap money after my dad died. I did this list of resentments. That's all I did. So I wasn't thorough at all. The second part of it, my sexual inventory, I wrote that stuff down, and my fears. I was afraid of everything. I was afraid of me. And I wrote those things down, not in the columns. I should have, but I didn't. And I went to a priest and did a confession. He thought he was giving me absolution. I thought I was doing a fifth step. Didn't matter. What I learned from that was, he said, there's a lady that comes in here every day, and goes to church every mass every day, and she comes to confession once a month. And she says, Father, I've had one sin. She only ever had one sin. She said, Father, I've had dirty thoughts. And he says, my daughter, you are not punished for your thoughts. You're punished for what you do. And I learned something from that. But the biggest one, and this is important for me, was important for me. I was at a meeting where they brought in two guys to talk about the steps. It's called Depth and Weight, I guess. And one guy was from Denver, one guy was from somewhere in Minnesota. And when they got to the fourth step, one guy said, why don't you talk to them about your vision of the inventory, the fourth step? And he said, in the book, it says you will swallow some big truths about yourself. He said, I challenge everyone in this room to write an inventory on the lie that you live. Because God did not create junk when he created you or me. He said, but somewhere early in life, someone that you saw as an authority figure, could have been a coach, a father, a mother, it could have been a priest, a rabbi, it could have been someone that you saw as an authority figure, said something to you that made you feel less than. That's the lie you live. It's a principle that you live that you don't know. And I thought it sounded interesting. He says, if one person writes an inventory on that, my trip here will be of great value. And so anyway, I'm outside. I still smoked at the time. So I'm outside and having a cup of coffee and a cigarette. It was a Sunday. And where I used to kneel down and pray And so anyway, all of a sudden the word worthless kept coming to mind. And then everything that he said came to mind. I didn't know why. I went inside. I turned on my computer and I looked up worthless. Worthlessness, and it said of no monetary value. Well, I made a lot of money. I was I used to say, well, they'll sure pay you a lot of money to pretend as in advertising, you know. And I didn't realize that my whole life was pretending. I'm in Chicago. I'm driving a bright yellow Mercedes retractable hardtop just to fit in, you know, with Outkast blazing on, you know, like on the thing, two dope boys in a Cadillac. I'm on my way to work, having a good old time in my head, and I didn't realize how ridiculous, well, not ridiculous, but I was having a good time. But I was slowly killing myself and didn't know it. So, anyway, I've now learned that the you know what Jonathan Swift once said, that the best things in life aren't things. How true is all that? How true that is. And been given a great gift by Alcoholics Anonymous. So, I wrote an inventory. It took about 10 minutes. And my father, who said to me, "You'll never make anything of yourself," and he pissed me off because I was making more money than he ever made. In fact, I lent them money when they were sh short of money. I gave them money. And he became in the second step, which is really, I think, interesting for me. Because the lie that I was living is that I was not worthy. I was not worthy of helping anybody. I was not, like, you know, and yet I was helping people all the time. I want to get to this tie because on it's a very important tie to me, very important. This is an example of how God was working in my life even when I was drunk. I was probably looking at porn, and all of a sudden, I wanted to see if I knew anybody that went down in the towers, the Twin Towers. As our son was working at a four-star restaurant on Pennsylvania Avenue, six blocks from the White House on 9/11, and I knew people in the district, the financial district, and stuff like that in New York. And all these pictures came on, all these pictures of people, and for some reason, a young man's picture, his name was Michael Desmond McCarthy, stuck out to me. Now, at the time I'm drinking, at the time I'm going to church, at the time I'm being a Eucharistic minister for the church, but I'm drinking myself to my grave. But I called New York Information, and I said, because I wanted to pray for that guy, for his family and that guy. I called up New York Information and I said, I know this is crazy, but I'm looking for a McCarthy in New York. I'm delusional? No, I've got all my mental. I'm fine. And they said, "Which borough?" And I said, "Excuse me." And she said, "Give me the names of the boroughs and everything." And I said, "Long Island." And she said, "Well, I can give you 10 names, but that's all I can give you. Then you got to call back." She gives me 10 names. Okay. I call the first person, the first McCarthy on Long Island. And I said, "Is Michael your son?" And they said, "No, we've heard of the family, but oh, no, it isn't." Second call, people say, "We've heard of the family, but no, he's not related." Third call, "You make your own choice on this. I'm talking to the guy's father." I said, "Mr. McCarthy, I want to pray for you and your family and for Michael." He took my address. This is hard for me. He sent me this tie and he sent me this card, his mass card. And he said Michael wore this every St. Patrick's Day. It was his favorite tie. And Michael was a young guy who didn't, he was just, anyway. So he was a young guy, not married. And I prayed for him and his family. And every St. Patrick's Day and every 9/11, I wear this tie no matter what I'm doing. This card, the interesting thing is on this card, on the back of this card, is the St. Francis prayer. Now you tell me that God wasn't working in my life and I didn't even freaking know it. I didn't even know it. So that's an important thing, and that's why I wore this tie today. So, because it's a part of, and it's also a part of my fourth step. Oh shit, am I going up? No. So it's a part of my fourth step, because now some people don't agree with this, but it's up to everybody. I wrote an inventory on the goodness and the good things that I did in my life. And certainly one was being a Eucharistic minister. Certainly another one was calling these people and saying, I'd like to pray for you. The heck am I, you know, I'm just drinking myself to death and I'm praying for others. So anyways, that was interesting to me and taught me. All of these things teach me as I'm going along, as I want to grow along spiritual lines. I now to, okay, so the sixth step, though, is very, very important to me. Very, very important. Maybe the second hardest step to practice. I call it the let go step, and it says it right at the end of the step. It says the willingness to let go of all of those character flaws that stand in the way of my usefulness to our Creator. May I go from here to do your bidding. I ask every day that I look at life through the eyes of love, the eyes of divine love. My idea, conception of God has changed so drastically. At the point where I thought that everything in this book, and as you can see, my parrot decided to read this big book before me, and it's falling apart, and they say you can get it put back together. I don't want to get it put back together. I still read it every day. So anyway, I call the sixth step my let go step. I've made a lot of amends. Truthfully, I made amends to people in Chicago. I wrote letters to people in Chicago that I had harmed. And the interesting thing about it is, I made those letters before I started stumbling through any steps. So I started with the ninth step. But people have used the copies of those letters to help other people, because I say, you loved me when I couldn't love me, you know, and I would say I'm sorry, but I said I'm sorry so many times I made it a lie. It isn't that. What can I do to make it right? What can I do to make it right? And that's the best way I've found through a number of amends. I was told that amends is like an amendment to the Constitution. You change your rules and you live by your new rules. Remnant of my smoking. But anyway, I don't do it anymore. But I found that the best way to make amends is to let people, I know I've harmed you in some way, or I think I've harmed you in some way. Interestingly enough, there was a bar that I went to every day after meetings. And I saw the owner of the bar at Home Depot, and I went up to him and I said, excuse me, but I hope I didn't do something to, hurt your business or hurt you or your customers. And he says, no, you are our entertainment. I had a good time drinking. I was given the gift of I can make people smile. I can make people laugh. I utilize that. I ask for the help with that. Because there's so many more things that I could talk about, but let me say this. When I'm at meetings, I can say how it works, and not because I sat and memorized it. No, I've just been to enough meetings where it seems to have happened. People that I admired in meetings, their peace of mind, would sit there with their eyes closed. So rather than looking at the girls walking in and all that other stuff and judging people, I would close my eyes, and I can say how it works. I read a wee version of the St. Francis prayer. I thank God for bringing us all to that meeting that day, because no matter what you think brought you to AA, think again, because there was something driving that, that is something that we can never comprehend, never understand. So I pray for you all every day. In every meeting, I say, you know, thank you for bringing us here today. Please guide us, direct us, come through us, and make us help each other, help us help each other, make us all channels of your peace. And I go through that while people are reading how it works. That's just what I do. I must give a plug for this fellow right here. This is an amazing book. It's called The Sermon on the Mount. And I do a lot of reading from Emmett Fox. I've got maybe five books of his. And that set aside prayer, I wish I could read what it, I don't have the time, but I wish I could read a page that I have folded over in an Emmett Fox book where he talks exactly about that. Forget everything you think you know. They're all old ideas, Paul. They're all old ideas. And that may be entirely true, but from the standpoint that I grew from those ideas, and I must find God now. I must, Ram Dass, who he used, when I found out who he was, he used to, he was, he and Timothy Leary, I think, were thrown out of Harvard because of LSD and everything. And he said, what we're really doing here is walking each other home. We're here to understand and to be understood, to love and to be loved. That's a wonderful way to look at it. I didn't learn that in my Catholic upbringing at all. However, it does say in A Vision for You, Paul, it says, you will learn the full meaning of love thy neighbor as thyself. I do know that now. I want to end with this. There's a fellow who is well worth listening to if you haven't, but oh gosh. The heck's his name? He played in a movie called One Life. Just went a mental lapse. But anyway, I'll probably think of his name when I tell you one of his sayings. He said, it is none of my business what anybody thinks of me or says about me. I am who I am, and I do what I do. I expect nothing, and I accept everything. And I went, damn. And I'll add to that, I judge no one, and I love everyone. Yeah, he played in One Life, and he played, who was the guy with the mask on like this. He's a Welsh actor. Anyway, God bless you all. I love you all. How can I say that? Because I don't judge you, you know? It's not my place to be judging anyone. A resentment is just something, a resentful feeling or judgment of any kind is just a way of tying something to myself that is uncomfortable. So why should I bother doing that? This is love and tolerance of others is our code. Who is more loving and tolerant than the God of our misunderstanding? God bless you and keep you well. Keep praying, keep coming, keep helping others, and keep well. Thank you for asking me to share this junk today called my life. Okay, which is, it's all good junk, believe me. Jim, thank you very much. And again, God bless you all. By the way, my number is in the chat. Anybody wants to